The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm excited to welcome these two very talented artists here today. Writer and teacher Matt De La Peña is the author of six acclaimed young adult novels, including Ball Don't Lie and Mexican White Boy, as well as the popular picture books A Nation's Hope, The Story of Boxing Legend Joe Louis, and the Newbery Medal-winning Last Stop on Market Street, a children's book that highlights volunteerism, income inequality, and other topics not often addressed by the genre. Lauren Long is the author and illustrator of the New York Times best-selling, tender and adorable Otis series of books, and he also illustrated Barack Obama's very popular Of Thee I Sing, Madonna's Mr. Peabody's Apples, and re-illustrated the children's classic, The Little Engine That Could. In their new book, Love, De La Peña and Long depict the wondrous ways we experience that most universal of bonds throughout our years. Please give a warm Philadelphia welcome from Matt De La Peña and Lauren Long.
Hello, how are you guys doing? Thank you for coming here today. This is the third leg of our tour that's going to go through all of 2018, we just learned. No, I'm just kidding. It's not that long.
Yeah.
But this is never the third leg. I think we have one more leg after this.
Yeah.
So this is exciting because it's not too far from where I live. I live in Brooklyn, so I feel like this is almost a home game. And Lauren lives in Cincinnati. And we're going to talk about one of the cool things for us is that we come from very different backgrounds and we live in different places. We have different family rituals. And it's really cool to sort of bring it together in a book called Love, because one of the things we wanted to do was talk about, you know, there's a lot of divisiveness in this country, but the one thing that sort of keeps us together, I think, is love. And so we're going to do that, right? We're going to start by reading the book. So, Love. In the beginning, there is light, and two wide-eyed figures standing near the foot of your bed, and the sound of their voices is love. A cab driver plays love softly on his radio while you bounce in back with the bumps of the city, and everything smells new, and it smells like life. Love, too, is the smell of crashing waves and a train whistling blindly in the distance, and each night the sky above your trailer turns the color of love. In a crowded concrete park, you toddle toward summer sprinklers while older kids skip rope and run up the slide, and soon you are running among them, and the echo of your laughter is love. On the night the fire alarm blares, you're pulled from sleep and whisked into the street where a quiet old lady is pointing to the sky. Stars shine long after they've flamed out, she tells you. And the shine they shine with is love. But it's not only stars that flame out, you discover. It's summers, too. And friendships. And people. One day, you find your family nervously huddled around the TV, but when you ask what happened, they answer with silence and shift between you and the screen. In your dream that night, you are searching for a love that seems lost. You open and close drawers, lift cushions, empty old toy bins, but there's nothing. You wake with a start in the arms of a loved one who bends to your ear and whispers, "It's okay, it's okay, it's love." And in time, you learn to recognize a love overlooked, a love that wakes at dawn and rides to work on the bus, a slice of burned toast that tastes like love, and its love in each deep crease of your grandfather's face as he lowers himself onto an overturned bucket to fish. And its love in the rustling leaves of gnarled trees lined behind the flower fields. And its love in the made-up stories your uncles tell in the backyard between wild horseshoe throws. And the man in rags outside the subway station plays love notes that lift into the sky like tiny beacons of light. And the face staring back in the bathroom mirror, this too is love. So when the time comes for you to set off on your own, heavy winds will sweep past your building and great gray clouds will congregate above. Your loved ones will stand there like puddles beneath their umbrellas, holding you tight and kissing you and wishing you luck. But it won't be luck you'll leave with, because you'll have love. You'll have love, love, love. Thank you guys for letting me read that to you. Okay, so here's what we're going to do now. We like to talk a little bit about the love that led us to love. So we, like as I said begin at the beginning, we come from different backgrounds, and we're going to kind of like talk a little bit about that. So for me, where did it start? It started on the border of Mexico and San Diego in a place called National City. My neighborhood was predominantly Mexican-American. I'm mixed race. My dad's Mexican and my mom's white. So here's a picture of me and my dad. You could tell I kind of liked tacos when I was a kid. My dad was very young when I was born. He was a teenager. He had to drop out of high school to get a job to provide for the family. And the cool thing is, me and my sisters, we sort of robbed our parents of their own childhoods. But the cool thing about this guy is he never missed a day of work. He never took a sick day. He got up every morning and went to work at his job. He got a job at the sanitation department at the San Diego Zoo. So when I think back about that, you know, to that, that was a form of love, that he just showed up every day. He was a very quiet man, but he went to work every day. And we didn't have much, but we always had what he brought home from his job. I also like his shirt in this picture. I would purchase that if I could find it. This is an amazing picture of me. I'm very proud of this photo. I look like a very attractive child. It's not the best photo, but I do like those booties. But this is my mom. She's white. In my young adult books, I talk a lot about growing up mixed race and what it means. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but mixed kids are the highest growing demographic in the country. More and more kids are growing up mixed. My own daughter, she's a quarter Mexican, a quarter white, and half Chinese. So we call her the Mexicasian. My mom was very young when I was born. She was 16. And she did graduate high school, but she was carrying me when she accepted her diploma on graduation day. But here's the thing. My parents come from very different backgrounds. My dad's first language was Spanish. My mom only spoke English. But here's what I say sometimes. There are times when you find a situation like this where my mom understood my dad's language without understanding the language. And why do I say that? Because they were both incredibly poor. My dad was, my mom was a foster kid, and so they sort of connected on a socioeconomic level. Now, I come from a family where nobody had ever been to college, and I had a dream early in my life to be the first in my family to go to college. I didn't think my parents could afford it. I didn't think I was ever going to get good enough grades to get an academic scholarship, but I was good at one thing. I was good at basketball. And it took me to college. And so I feel like I owe so much of who I am today to the game of basketball, because it took me to college. And when I got there, I fell in love with books. I fell in love with reading books. I fell in love with writing books. And I started to foster a new dream. What if I could make a book of my own? And so we're briefly going to talk to you guys a little bit about the books that come before love. So I'll just show you a couple. This is my first book, Ball Don't Lie. I remember I said, I'll never, ever write a book about basketball when I graduated undergrad. And I made it 3 weeks before I started a book about basketball. but I feel like this got me there. Second book's called Mexican White Boy. It's about growing up mixed race. And I also write picture books. Here's one of them, Last Stop on Market Street. And this book, I was starting to explore something that ended up being kind of prominent in love, which is this idea of how do you figure out how to love yourself? And so this led, for me, to love. And now Lauren is going to talk to you a little bit about his background and where he comes from.
One of the, like Matt said, one of the fun things about this experience is getting to know Matt and understanding, you know, the culture and background that he came from and the difference in his upbringing and mine. And he lived near the ocean, near the Mexico border in San Diego, and when he was a little guy. And I lived in another faraway exotic land called Missouri. And this is my family, Matt, the Missouri family. Two older brothers, mom, dad. Some of you children's literature folks may know of John Sheshka. And if we had three more brothers, we would have been the Sheshkas. But that's me over here, Matt. My parents weren't artists. I like to talk to, when we're talking to kids, I like to ask them how many of them like to draw. And then how many of them have seen their mom or dad or somebody else draw a picture? I never saw mom or dad. Dad was basically a traveling salesperson. Mom was a secretary. this is our home in Joplin, Missouri. And I never, ever saw my parents draw. We didn't have artists. We didn't know artists. At this point, I just love to do sports and things. And the next photo is me at, we moved to Kentucky, which is another faraway exotic land. And this is me in my backyard, and horses were all around. At this point in time, I was into two things, sports and art. So I like to say my two favorite subjects in school were PE and art. And I wasn't a particularly great reader. It was hard for me to sit with a page of books. And you know those reluctant readers. I was the definition of that emergent, reluctant reader. I think it's one of the reasons I like to draw so much, because it felt like play to me, whereas reading a whole page of text, I was famous for reading and then forgetting what I had just read. It was very frustrating, and I never felt like the best student in the class as a result of that. But in art class, I started getting a little extra attention. I love to draw horses. I always tell the kids, Leonardo da Vinci's known for the Mona Lisa, but his favorite subject matter was the horse. And I think it was just the sheer beauty of that physical anatomy of that creature that was just so gorgeous. So here I am on my 11th birthday. Next slide is me with my high school art teacher. You can see the look on her face. This is me, by the way. I wore my hair differently in the day. And this is me making my first oil painting. I love this photo because it shows this love in this stranger. I was just a kid in her class. I wasn't that great of a student. By this time, I was playing soccer before soccer was cool. And here I am making my first oil painting, studying a magazine that probably no doubt had a picture of a horse in it. I didn't go to an art museum until I was in college, unless we visited my grandmother in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and went to the Gilcrease Hills Museum, which was filled with Frederick Remington paintings. And what were his paintings of? The West, filled with horses. It made a huge impression on me. I would sit there for hours when my cousins and my brothers would go running off. And finally, grandmother started taking a separate car so that I could stay and look at the art. But I just love how she's the first one that really showed me a lot of extra attention. She's the one that would bring in Vincent Van Gogh book, Da Vinci book, the Italian Renaissance painters. Hey, Lauren, here's Norman Rockwell. Have you ever heard of him? And she would say, come here. And I would just pore over this stuff. And the attention she was giving me was love. About this time, I guess I'll tell this story. About this time, so I was around 15 here. About this time, I needed to get glasses. The chalkboard started getting fuzzy. My mom took me to an optometrist. And I'll never forget this, Matt. It was Nicholasville, Kentucky, of all places, near Lexington. She takes me to an optometrist to get my eyes checked. No big deal. Did the screening. Doctor walks out into the lobby. Mrs. Long, Lauren's nearsighted. He just needs to wear corrective lenses when he's watching movies or when he's in the classroom looking at the chalkboard. No big deal. Here's your prescription. We're saying goodbye. And he said, oh, wait, Mrs. Long, did you know your son is colorblind? And I kind of tensed up. And I had just decided maybe this is my calling. Maybe this is what I'm better at than anything else. He said, it's no big deal, Mrs. Long. Like 12 out of every male, 12% of every male has a red-green color blindness. It's no problem. Many of us live with it. I see somebody in the crowd. Yeah, that's right. Fist bump. Yeah, it's like no big deal. 12% of males have it, much less common in females. It's no big deal unless he wants to be an electrician or a dermatologist. You have to really discriminate color hue and subtle. And then he chuckled and said, or an artist. I get in the car, a tear starts streaming down my face. I'm this, you know, young person. My mother says to me, Lauren, what's wrong? And I said, through tears, he said, artist. And my mom, I'll never forget this, Matt, she grabbed my knee and squeezed it very hard as she was driving probably too fast, gripped the steering wheel, and through gritted teeth, she said, Lauren, your art is beautiful. Don't ever let anyone tell you you can't be an artist. I look back on that, Matt, and I think, what if I hadn't had that strong, immediate voice from my mother immediately saying, you can be an artist. Don't listen to anybody else. I would have listened to that optometrist. He was a doctor. He was a person of authority. And he had just told me I can't be an electrician, a dermatologist, or an artist. Maybe I would have given up. And that act that my mom gave me, that strength, immediate, was love.
You ended up becoming an artist, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Maybe we should kind of show what.
Yeah.
In honor of the optometrist.
So, Mr. Fancy Pants optometrist from Nicholasville, Kentucky in 1970-something, here's some of my books. You ever heard of The Little Engine That Could, Mr. Optometrist? I re-illustrated it. Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, here's some of my work. I'm painting in acrylic paints most of my career. I'll share the art technique I use for love in a second. Big honor in my career to this day, illustrating The Little Engine That Could, which was my favorite book when I was little, my mother read to me, the 1954 edition. Who would have thought, Matt, that I would ever write something? If you met me when I was a kid, you would have thought, that guy's never going to write something. I would have agreed. But I realized it's not about being the best student in the class. It's about having ideas. And once I started illustrating other people's stories, I had some ideas of my own. One of them was about a little tractor on the farm. And during the summer in college, you went to the University of Kentucky, by the way. During the summer in college, I worked on a horse farm, and they wouldn't let you near the horses because those were the lifeline of the farm and the industry. But they let us mow and weed eat, and we drove a little tractor. The college boys used to take turns, and it was a little 50s Ford. It had two wheels on the front. But later when I had the idea for Otis the tractor, that little tractor definitely inspired Otis. And I've been very proud. It's been a gift to my career, Otis the tractor. There are 6 books in all. They make lovely gifts. And then, believe it or not, I wrote a story called Drummer Boy, and I did a book called Toy Boat, a lot of books. And there was a family in the south side of Chicago, Matt, that was reading books to their two little daughters. This man was a law professor at the University of Chicago. And believe it or not, they were reading some Lauren Long books. Who would have thought? He became a U.S. senator, and when he was a senator, he wrote an inspiring letter to his daughters called A V.I. Singh, A Letter to My Daughters. And you may know where I'm going with this. When he became president of the United States, President Barack Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to publish a children's picture book. And he called Lauren Long. Cincinnati.
Did he clear it through the optometrist?
Through the optometrist. So he called Lauren Long from Cincinnati. Who's she? Yeah. Well, he had read some of my books. Michelle and them had read to Sasha and Malia. It's unbelievable. And we published Of the I Seeing, A Letter to My Daughters. Everywhere I go, people sometimes want to ask me, did I meet President Obama? Unlike working with Matt De La Pena, I didn't have any contact with President Obama during the production of the book, you could imagine. He was a little harder to reach than Matt. But after the book published, I met him. I took my sons. We were in the Oval Office. And it was just a wonderful experience. He bragged about me, Matt, in front of my two sons, standing in the Oval Office. Ah. Anyway, wonderful experience. When those two sons, the oldest started going, preparing to go to college. I've got two college boys. It's hard for me to even say that. But I wrote a story called Little Tree about letting go of things that are bothering you. It bothered me to no end that my son was getting old enough to leave my house for the first time in 18 years. It bothered me. I couldn't change it. It was a problem. I couldn't go back. There are no do-overs. So I wrote this little story about a little tree who was afraid to let go of his leaves. It comforted me, and maybe it'll comfort other people.
And that led you. That was the book that you did right before Love, right?
I think so. Yeah.
And so what we would love to do, because Lauren actually... I really admire this about him. He's been working for over a decade, and he had a specific style. And what I love is that when he got this text, he tried something new. So now we're going to take you through his technique. First, I'm going to talk briefly about what I was trying to do with the poem. Lauren's got two kids in college. I have a girl, daughter in nursery school. So we're on the different ends of the parenting cycle. It was hard for me to transition from watching the news. This was during the election cycle, and I was like, wow, the country is so divided. You know, it's hard for me to, you know, see some of the darkness that's out there in the country right now, and how people, you know, immediately if they find out you have a different ideology, I could never be friends with that person. So I was leaving the news and then going into my daughter's bedroom to read books to her, but also to talk about life to her. And I was like, how do you make that transition? And one of the things I wished I could do was read her a book that was just all about love. And there are some great ones out there. But I said, you know what? I'm going to try to write this for her. Now, after I wrote the first draft, I thought, you know, I like this poem. It does feel a little uplifting, but there was something missing in the poem. And what I realized is I had not even acknowledged any sense of adversity. And I honestly thought I want to err on the side of being truthful rather than just telling something that is saccharine. So I said, I'm going back in and I'm going to tell the truth. So I wrote the poem, and it included some moments that are a little challenging, although Lauren and I both are very conscious to say there's love in every moment. Even the tougher moments, there's still love in every moment in the book. So now, I've written the text. It took me 6 months to revise it over and over and over, because when I write a picture book, I think I have two jobs. I have to get the story right, and then I have to get the music right. And the part that takes the longest for me is getting the music right. When I was young, I used to write spoken word poetry. Some people say, hey, is it hard to go from writing novels to writing picture books? And I say, actually, it's like going home. It's just like writing a spoken word poem. And then I'm lucky enough to have an illustrator like Lauren make it bigger and better than it could be on its own. So we wanted to look at one piece. I'm going to read the text to you, and then Lauren, maybe you can take us through your thought process. This was a hard book to illustrate because it's some of it's intangible, right? And it doesn't follow a specific character. It jumps through the country. This is one piece that actually changed at the end, and we'll talk about that too. And in time, you learn to recognize a love overlooked, a love that wakes at dawn and rides to work on the bus, a pair of old house slippers that fit like love. So Lauren, you get this text. What do you do?
This is a snapshot of this text. So this is the manuscript when it comes to me. I was immediately interested because I've always tried to give love and through all of my art because of my audience for children. I see this when I'm by myself. You can see I kind of tend to use either blue ink or colored pencils to do all of my concepting. So I'm thinking, it's brainstorming. I'm writing little notes. You can barely read them. But you know, here I'm thinking it's winter, you know. So it's just streams of thought responding. But this is when I feel like I'm a movie director, I'm a filmmaker. I think a lot of children's book illustrators feel like they're filmmakers because you're trying to get inside them emotion. You are the casting director, which was important in this film because we wanted to be, oops.
Sorry, thank you. Let's see, should I start over from the very beginning?
Let's take it from the top.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of myself as a film director. I'm thinking of myself as the casting director for this film. And it's very important, Matt, because this text, we wanted to be all-inclusive because we really wanted to touch the essence of love. So I'm in my studio, I'm thinking as a film director, I'm thinking like Steven Spielberg, and I'm thinking, and in time you learn to recognize a love overlooked, which I love, because now we're not just passively taking love in Matt's text, we're recognizing it in places that aren't so obvious. A love that wakes at dawn and rides to work on the bus. All right, I'm staying with it. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have a lone child with his back turned to the viewer, like in a film, and he's going to be putting his hand on the window as he watches a bus leave in the morning, in a snowy morning. So I came up with this sketch, and I'm thinking, all right, I'm kind of nailing it. And then I'm thinking, how clever am I? I'm going to put slippers, oversized slippers. So I'm thinking, yeah, I'm pretty proud of myself. Then I was like, but this doesn't quite nail it. This, if you look at that, I like my pictures to tell a story, not only of what the text says, but even beyond. And I was worried that this would feel like almost a Home Alone scene, like a desertion, this child left alone. So I came back with, I need to show the parent. So I came back with this. I'm still trying to cast this film. I'm still being the prop master of this film. I'm still deciding what kind of family this child is from. So I've got a more, perhaps, luxurious apartment.
You're still sort of working through the choice of underwear, too.
Exactly. Yeah. You can see that I'm really digging deep. It's like, I think I need to be honest. He'd have tidy whities. But you see, I've got the parent now walking to the bus. Still felt, I had a note in his hand in the picture, and that was sort of, in my mind, a note of chores that the parent left. I've taken that away. I'm still thinking, I've still got the slippers, and I still think that's good, but it just still felt short. It still felt too isolated. I've illustrated Matt's words here, but I haven't brought a whole lot to it. So I thought, what about another form of love? What if I was this little child, and I had a sibling, and I did this drawing? I've made the window smaller. I've changed, even by taking some of the stuff out, I've changed the demographic of this particular scene. And at this point, I felt, okay, now we have this love recognizing,
but we've also brought a whole nother element to the picture.
So then I get it. I get it in my inbox, because usually illustrators and writers don't communicate during the course of a picture book, although we did. We talked all through it, but I still had some surprise moments when I would get the sketches. This is one. I open it up on my computer, I look at the image, and I go, where are my slippers? Where are these slippers? But then I actually thought to myself, and by the way, I want to tell you, this has never happened in my career. I looked at the sketch, and I looked at this brother, and I had never thought of this brother. And so this was a new element in the story, and I thought, oh my gosh, this guy, he probably wants to get to school and hang out with his buddies. But before he does, there's this gesture, like he's going to give his brother toast. I also said, you know what, I don't think this guy's great at toast. I don't trust his toast-making skills. So I came up with a line, a slice of burnt toast that tastes like love, because I also love that it's not perfect, it's amateur. But I love that, and you know what? I changed the text based on the sketch. That's never happened in my career. Are you proud of yourself?
Yes.
So now maybe you want to take us through how you actually approached the
art. So when I read, I'd been painting similarly with water-based paints, acrylic paint mainly, trying to paint like an oil painter, like N.C. Wyeth, my whole career. And I did deviate with the Otis books and painted with gouache, which is kind of an opaque watercolor, but still a very similar approach. I'll point out briefly, maybe 50%, if not a little more, of children's books today are being created, at least in part, digitally. And they're doing amazing stuff, amazing work. They're doing some things that I can't do. I admire what they do. I respect it. I might do it at some point myself. But right now, I still enjoy getting my hands dirty and painting like I did when I was in seventh grade, you know, when I was just learning. So I still do everything by hand. I may change down the road. I got Matt's text. I'm like, oh, wow, this is Love by Matt De La Pena. But when you read it, it digs a little deeper. It goes places I wasn't expecting. He talks about the beauty of love, but also the vulnerability of love. The love's overworked in places and underworked in others. Love, frankly, can be a little messy. And I loved the rawness of his text, and I just thought, this is a time when I've got to try something new. I had taken a class in printmaking about 2 years ago. I've always been interested in printmaking because I'm a painter who overworks his art into oblivion at times. It's a thing. And I loved printmaking. How many people have done monotypes or any form of printmaking out here? Darn,
a few of you. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. So my apologies to all of you because I'm a beginner. Completely raw. I took a printmaking sort of for beginners, literally, class, an evening class at the Art Academy of Cincinnati. There were three people in the class, and one never showed up. So I had this wonderful instructor to pick his brain for 8 weeks for 3 hours a night, one night a week. And I thought, I'm going to do monotype prints because you put that art, I'll walk you through the process, and some of you guys know more about this than me. I'd never done it. You make your art on a plate. This is a plexiglass plate. This is an actual plate I used on the uncle scene. Take something called a little roller or brayer. You ink it up. So I was working with oil-based inks. I got colors that I never would have gotten out of my own, left to my own device, especially considering my color vision episode a few minutes earlier that I discussed. I inked up the plate, and then I would just roll on this color, roll on this color, roll on this, painted in the flesh tones with a paintbrush, and then took a cotton swab or paper towel and wiped away the parts that I didn't want to show up. So you take that down to my little makeshift print studio in my basement there in Cincinnati. Take that inked up plate, lay it on the bed of the press, then take a variety of different types of printmaking paper that had been soaked and blotted so that ink will soak right up into the paper. lay the paper down on top of it, and then roll it through that press. And then this is what comes out. Now I'm like, oh man, my compositions are very detailed. So I'm not quite good enough as a printmaker yet to do this all. Now, how many of you guys have ever collaged art? Yeah, again, I apologize. I've never done it before. You're probably much more accomplished. But I thought, okay, I still love the textures. I don't want to give up on that. It's unexpected. It's a little raw. I can't control it, which was fun for me. So I went over. I'm going to cut that out in a second. I printed the background on a separate plate. This one was the first one. I'm like, ah, it's too dark. I'll try to run that same plate through. They call it a ghost print. And I ran through the second one. I loved it. I would never have painted this by hand. Never in my wildest imagination. But I thought, this is great. I'm going to have this warm inside and cool outside. But I liked this window better, so I cut it out, moved it over. I'm going to glue this window into there. And then next, I'll cut these figures out. And then I'll place them and glue them down. I even hinged it down here because that glue was very unforgiving. Once it touched, it was history. It was going to stay there. So then I've got my composition. So this is when I kind of relied on whatever skills I've accumulated over the years as a painter, brought in and finished the painting with some colored pencils and paintbrush. But I'm very concerned still about the emotional connection in Matt's text, those raw emotions that are throughout the book. So this is when I went in. Very little detail on that face, but just the right look, the right movement, the right motion. You know, you want people to feel your words, Matt. You want them to hear that music. I want them to feel my art. I don't want them to just look at it. I want them to feel it. And this is the final picture.
And this is about the time that Lauren found out that the line had changed. And so look at the toast right there. That looks like a good piece of toast. So what did he do? The very last detail? He darkened the toast.
Burned it. Yeah.
So it was a really cool process to be a witness to. Now, before we turn it to you guys for questions, I wanted to show you a couple things. Did you have something? Is there something you wanted to say?
Nope.
Oh, you look like you were ready.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that it became my favorite line of the piece, of the book. Maybe not my favorite moment, but I love that slice of burnt toast. Yeah.
Yeah. And no, it's a great example of the collaboration we did. We sat down and talked about the ideas of all the lines before he started really getting into the sketching. So that was so fun. Now, the reason that they keep the writer away from the illustrator is because they're scared that the writer will take too much ownership of the book and will dictate what should be, you know, painted or illustrated. I was very aware of that. I felt like it was a gift that I could talk to Lauren, so I was never prescriptive. We just talked about our philosophies, who should be in the book. And then Lauren came up with everything else. So there's a couple things I wanted to highlight. For me, it's my favorite moment in the book. Why? Because look at these parents. They have a direct line of vision to their child who's leaving. And in this illustration, it's a 6-year-old, a 5-year-old. When I'm writing a picture book, I have to be in the point of view of the child, right? But I've met so many people who have what I call the imposter syndrome. So they get a new job, they go to a great school, and they walk in and go, oh, when are they going to realize that I don't belong here? I think going off on your own is a form of that too. It's a similar idea. So that kid might be 18, but he or she feels, you know, still like a young person. And I think from the point of view of the parents, that's true too. This is a big moment for me. First of all, this is my grandmother's house. And one of the things Lauren did is he texted me and he said, hey, your grandma's house, like, what would be in this? Do you want to, like, talk about that? Yeah, it's kind of like kind of a cool little.
Yeah, and it's another example of, like Matt was saying, he doesn't want to step on my toes. I didn't want to step on his toes, but I knew getting to know Matt would strengthen my work, what I'm bringing to this. This is an example of, if you see the original sketch, I called it the 9/11 moment. You know, that's just my reference in my life. This I was specific to not show what's on that screen, because that's a different moment for all of us. But I remember I had this thing, and again, going through and casting my film and choosing to represent everyone, I had decided that this needed to be some type of Mexican or Hispanic family. And doing my homework, doing my research as an illustrator, I'm thinking, who do I know that's Mexican? So I text, because I'm a pro, right? I'm an illustrator. I've been around the block. I'm going to do my research. I'm going to dig deep. I text Matt. Hey, Matt, what was in your house when you grew up in a Mexican household? And within seconds, he emails me back a list of like 12 things. Well, you got to have doilies. Doilies are everywhere. You have to have a crucifix on the wall. You have to have a Jesus painting somewhere on the wall. The grandmother would have a pot holder, and she'd maybe have a spatula, and she'd probably have an apron. And my whole life, there was a portrait of Frida Kahlo staring down at me. So I go through, and I put in the Jesus portrait. I put in the crucifix. I put the doily after I figured out what a doily was. And then I decorate in my art, and put the Frida Kahlo portrait in, and my art director calls when she's going through, very effusively, by the way, my art, and she's showering me with praise, which felt wonderful. She's like, Lauren, your research just amazes me. The 9/11 scene, the Mexican family, you just really go through and don't leave any stone unturned. You really do your homework. And I said, no, that was, thank you.
And you know, I wanted to say a couple more things about this. So the screen is, it's just light. And here's the way I envision this. And this is why the text is not specific. Because sadly, what's on that screen, every week, it's something new. Isn't that sad? If you read this a month from now, you will see something new that has just happened. Also, though, this is from the point of view of the child, right? I'm writing a children's book. So that child is not allowed to get close enough to that screen to know what it is. And this is actually one of the moments that leads to the sort of what I call the fall from grace. Love is in this child's life. And this act by the grandmother is an act of love. She's like, you know what? Stay there, mija. We don't want you to come see this. Like, this, you're too young for this. But in doing that, she separated the child from the family. And now the child is there's a distance. And Lauren even sort of made it more defined by having that line there. And yeah. And I think this is an interesting moment in childhood. And so that leads to the dream, which leads to the child realizing I have to look for love. And if we're lucky, we have somebody who loves us. And we're all going to go through things, right? Every single one of us, every one of our children. But if we're lucky, we have somebody who, in the midst of this darkness, can bend to your ear and say, it's okay, it's okay, it's love. And then last but not least, I wanted to end our kind of talk before we turn to you with this face. You know, I go into a lot of schools. And when I go into a private school, every kid is like, hey, here's an author. They take ownership of the author visit. They love it. They've done it before. They know how it goes. But sometimes I'll go into a poor school. They've never had an author. It's run down. There's no funding to make improvements on the physical building. And sometimes a kid will say this. It's happened to me many times. Could be a high school or it could be an elementary school. They'll look at me and discreetly say, hey, mister, why would you come here? In other words, we don't deserve your time. We're not worthy. I think one of the most important moments of a child's life is, yes, they're actively looking for love in the world, but at some point, they have to look in the mirror and find it in themselves. I think that's a big moment in a child's life before they can go off on their own. But there's a second thing happening here. This child, and Lauren talked about this face had to be brown. It was vital. This child is looking at us and saying, I dare you not to recognize my existence. So that's kind of big. And if you don't mind, Lauren, I just wanted to like show a couple of the, I'm just going to flash through some of the work you did to find this. So this is the line. It's very skeletal. And this is where you began. And there you have it. Could we turn to you guys if you guys have any questions about the technique? I think we have a couple minutes left before we have to get kicked out. Who said I have a question?
Well, hi, everyone. I really enjoyed being here. I'm kind of in the steps of trying to get together a children books. And I love how you went through the process of how love came to be, this children's book. I want to know, how do you know when you actually found maybe a good illustrator for a children's book? Like, what questions could you ask maybe the illustrator to just really understand if this would be the perfect illustrator for your book?
So for me as the writer, I think what I have to do is look at people's work, look at what they've done before, and see if the aesthetic, the worldview, matches what I'm trying to convey. And I will tell you, Lauren and I have the same agent. And I went to my agent and I said, could we get Lauren? And I don't know if he knows this, but the one book that really was what made me think he's the right guy is his Obama book. Because I was trying to meet Obama. No, I'm just kidding. It was the work in there. And I was really like, I said, oh my gosh, he illustrated Obama's book. And I'm just kind of moved by his grace. And not only his grace, but his wife's grace. And so...
You're talking about me or my wife? Oh, President Obama's.
Yeah. Okay. But so, you just know, clarifying. If you're lucky, you get somebody who's incredibly talented. But, you know, there are also beginners, and they might do something amazing, too. So it just, I think it's your own aesthetic.
My perspective on that, too, if you're an unpublished, you know, you're arriving to this field as an aspiring writer for the first time, I would take some advice of the famous writer Angela Johnson, who I illustrated a couple of her books early. She doesn't think about the illustrator. She writes her story and leaves enough room in it for the editor and the publisher to choose the right illustrator. And I think that would be my advice, because especially in the beginning, authors don't often have any say over who the illustrator is.
Yep.
And it's kind of almost more of a non-collaboration.
Which is exciting too, because you see what they
exciting
do.
Exciting too, yeah. You write, somebody else illustrates, and they both take ownership of that book.
Yeah.
I was asking about diversity. What level of diversity did you want? Like, there was a girl in a headscarf there.
And yeah.
It looked like every one of the images were diverse.
Yep.
At what level did you say, hey, you know, I just want it to be diverse Hispanically or
well,
whatever?
I think what we try to do as artists, I think art by nature is a form of activism. You know, I just think that when we make art, we're doing it for a reason with a purpose. The one thing that we talked about the most is that we just wanted, I think, Lauren, we talked about, we just wanted to reflect our country. And we also wanted people from different ideological standpoints to be in the same book. There's a guy on a trailer. I think he has one political leaning. He's in the same book as this girl with a hijab, but they both have love. And that's what we were kind of trying to do, right?
Would you? Yeah, it is. The first book, I've talked with Matt about this. What can I say? You know, what I'm not looking like me from where I'm from. I don't view myself as a political person or whatever. It's driving me crazy, right? But there's a certain form of empathy that Matt and I want to bring to love. And I recall the first time I thought about we need diverse books, and I'm wholeheartedly supporting that. And I want to support that. And the way I can be an activist, and the way I can say something looking like I look, is through my art and through the books I do and some of the choices I make. I did a book called I Dream of Trains, written by Angela Johnson, an African-American writer from Kent, Ohio. Very first book. I was working pretty realistically in that time, and I needed a model. I needed a young African-American model, because it was based on a sharecropper's son. I went to this family in my son's school. I said, hey, do you mind if I use your son as a model. And this young mother said, she had four kids. She said, oh my gosh, I would love if you do that. I'm always trying to find books that have African-American kids in them, and it's a lot harder than you think. And it was the first time, now this is going back to 2003, it was the first time that occurred to me. I didn't understand the privilege I enjoyed never having to think about that when I read to my two little boys who look like me. So it's become important to me.
I just have a quick comment. I'm a grown-up. Listening to this and the coming together of the two different art forms, writing and illustrating, just makes me miss the fact that, I read a lot, but the books I read aren't illustrated, and it's kind of a shame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should read more picture books. Yeah.
You know what's interesting is people think, hey, a picture book, this is for a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old. The truth is, when I go to high schools, I read love. And it's so crazy, the response. They get more out of it because they're bringing more to it, you know? It's interesting.
I read picture books to my college boys, you know, because it's what I'm about. So I'm like, hey, come on, let's share this little movie together. And you could take picture books into high school classes and college classes. Last Stop on Market Street should be read to every high school kid, you know? Do you have one?
Yes, I just wanted to say your book is beautiful. But sitting here listening to you and everything that you've been saying, but I just think you two are hilarious and work so well together. I think you should write a book about yourselves, a comedy. It was great. Yeah. I mean, you make me cry, but then you also make me laugh.
The only problem is I'm getting a little sick of this guy. We've been on the road a lot. We have dinner every night. No, it's been great. I think we would love to do something.
There was a woman in line in Austin, and she said, "Oh, Matt, you just make me cry. Your words are so deep." And then she looked at me and said, "And you're funny."
And by the way, I was mad.
And
I was
later, Matt said, "I'm still mad at that woman that said you were the funny one."
Why are you the funny one?
And I'm like, "Oh, I'll be Jerry Lewis to your Dean Martin. Yeah, I'll trade you."
But seriously, guys, thank you so much on such a beautiful day for coming to check out our book, Love. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.